quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. You must understand, the leading Bolsheviks who took over Russia were not Russians. They hated Russians. They hated Christians. Driven by ethnic hatred, they tortured and slaughtered millions of Russians without a shred of human remorse. The October Revolution was not what you call in America the, quote, Russian Revolution. It was an invasion and conquest over the Russian people. More of my countrymen suffered horrific crimes at their blood-stained hands than any people or nation ever suffered in the entirety of human history. It cannot be overstated. Bolshevism committed the greatest human slaughter of all time. The fact that most of the world is ignorant and uncaring about this enormous crime is proof that the global media is in the hands of the perpetrators.
Решение о национализации этой библиотеки было принято советским правительством, первым советским правительством, и членами его являлись примерно на 80-85% евреи. Но они же, руководствуясь ложными идеологическими соображениями, шли тогда на аресты и репрессии и иудеев, и православных, и представителей других конфессий, мусульман. Они всех гребли под одну гребенку. И вот эти идеологические шоры и ложные идеологические установки, они, слава Богу, рухнули.
Now, another aspect to understand when it comes to figuring out what the driving forces were behind apartheid is not just the fact that they felt they needed to separate the races because the races couldn't get along, but it's communism. Ah, yes, the C word. So, very, very briefly, let me just sort of put this in context. So, in 1917, the US came into World War I on the side of the French and the British. This created such a disproportionate amount of power that the Germans had to close off the Eastern Front by getting Russia out of the war. The way they did that was they shipped a whole bunch of Jewish communists into Russia, who then fomented a revolution, took over from the Mensheviks, the Bolsheviks, and then destroyed Russia. It was horrendous. And millions of people starved to death because communism doesn't work. It's a horrible economic theory and a horrible and destructive and incredibly genocidal implementation when you starve to death, right? So what happened was when the communists got into power, they slaughtered millions of Christians because it's very explicitly atheistic, hostile to religion philosophy. So the Bolsheviks got into power and slaughtered a whole bunch of Christians. And so when Christians see communists trying to get into power, they feel it's us versus them. This is what the Germans felt when the communists were trying to get into power in Russia in the 1920s and 1930s, sorry, in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s. They thought, well, God, if the communists get into power in Germany, they're going to kill all of us Christians. So that was one of the driving forces behind National Socialism. A bit of an overreaction, of course. So the Calvinists, the Protestants, they feared communism because of the communist genocide against Christians that had occurred in a variety of countries, in particular, of course, of Russia, in Russia. Here's how one historian describes the Afrikaner relationship with communism. Quote, the image of the Bolsheviks horrified the rank and file Afrikaner, eventually making the latter into probably the staunchest and most consistent anti-Soviet grouping on the planet. The horrors under Stalin sealed the fate of the communist philosophy in Afrikaner minds. It was not so much the socialist philosophy as the total disrespect for religion and human life that created in the staunchly Calvinistic Afrikaner nothing but utter revulsion. Afrikaner saw communism as the prime evil. So that the issue of race and communism went hand in hand for the Afrikaners is apparent in the fact that the National Party passed the Population Registration Act and the Suppression of Communism Act at the same time. The former was the first apartheid law that formalized racial classification, while the latter outlawed the South African Communist Party and defined communism as any scheme that encourages feelings of hostility between the European and the non-European races.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the first document that I'm going to show you is the one that shocked me perhaps the most. Here is a document which I couldn't possibly believe was on the level myself when I found it in the Library of Congress. That's where I got it. Here is the photostat of it right here in the form that you get it from us. This is one of the pamphlets with all the photostatic documents. This one is a full-page article from the London. You can cite it yourself and get it from your own library if you don't want to send it to me for it. Here's the citation. London Illustrated Sunday Herald, February 8, 1920. At the time of the Russian Revolution, or right after it. Page 5. Here is the full page available to you so you can see it all. Now, I can't read it all. I haven't got time. I'm going to take some selected portions. I'm going to first give you the title and what it's about. The title is Zionism versus Bolshevism, a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people. And the author, ladies and gentlemen, is a man that there is no person in this audience can say is a bigot or a fascist or a Nazi. The author is the Right Honorable Winston S. Churchill. In case somebody would say it's the Churchill who runs the garage, another Churchill that runs a garage down on 3rd Street, here's his picture, and you can judge whether it's the right Churchill or not. In this article, he says the Jewish people are dividing up into two groups. One group, he says, is for Zionism, and they want to take Palestine away from the Arabs who's had it for 2,000 years, and he thinks that's great. This is what Winston Churchill believed, and he says Zionism is good, and these are religious Jews, and we should give them Palestine. Well, so much for that. That's what he says up to here. But he says the other half of world Jewry is going another way. Here he talks about international Jews, and I would like to read you, not George Wallace or Adolf Hitler or George Lincoln Rockwell, I would now like to read you the words of Winston Churchill on the Russian Revolution, ladies and gentlemen. Please listen carefully and see if you are not as shocked as I was, because you have never heard this sort of information. I never did. In violent opposition to all this Zionist sphere of Jewish effort rise the schemes of the international Jews. The adherents of this sinister confederacy are mostly men reared up among the unhappy populations of countries where Jews are persecuted on account of their race. And parenthetically, surely you all know the Jews were persecuted in Russia. He says, from the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky in Russia, Bella Kuhn in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, and Emma Goldman in the United States, this worldwide, and this is Churchill's definition of communism, and I think it's pretty good. This worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence and impossible equality has been steadily growing. Now remember, he's talking about the international Jews. Now listen to this. Here's the shocker. It has been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century. And now, at last, this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworlds of the great cities of Europe and America, not Russia, this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire. Here was Winston Churchill indicating to me that all of these people he named, from Marx to Rosa Luxemburg, Bella Kuhn, were Jewish, and he says the Jewish confederacy all over the world have seized the Russian people by the hair of their heads and become the masters of the Russian empire. In other words, he says the Russian Revolution was not Russian. It was the capture of Russia by Jews who had been persecuted, rose up and took the country away. That's what he says right here in the article. Anybody who says, oh, send for it. Read the whole article. I got a few more paragraphs I'd like to read you. He says there is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. It is a very great one and probably outweighs all others. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of the leading figures of the Russian Revolution are Jews. Moreover, the principal inspiration and driving power comes from the Jewish leaders. Thus, Chechen, a pure Russian, now listen to this carefully, because this is the system they use in the United States, this is the system they're using all over the world right now. When people say, why, there's no Jews running communism now, listen to what Churchill says. Thus, Chechen, a pure Russian, is eclipsed by his nominal subordinate, Litvinov. And the influence of Russians like Bukharin or Lunacharsky cannot be compared with the power of Trotsky or Zinoviev. In other words, he says, at the top level, they have a Gentile who is a front. And right under him, they have the Jewish leader who is the real driving power. That's not Rockwell speaking. That's what Churchill says in this article. Remember the two names, he says, the two guys that are the real driving power, Litvinov and Trotsky.
The U.S. State Department, in its three-volume report on the origins of communism in Russia, published in 1931, reveals how Jewish-controlled German banks, under the leadership of Max Warburg, conspired as early as 1914 to send large payments to Lenin, Trotsky, and others in their attempts to bring down the Tsar. As part of this conspiracy, Jacob Schiff, head of the New York Jewish banking house of Kuhn Loeb, invested at least $20 million, which would be close to $1 billion today, toward the establishment of Bolshevism in Russia. In its article on socialism, the Jewish Encyclopedia, published in 1905, freely admits that Jews in Russia were ripe for revolution. In Russia, it, socialism, has become a movement of the Jewish masses. The later Encyclopedia Judaica tells us the communist movement and ideology played an important part in Jewish life, particularly in the 1920s and 1930s, and during and after World War II. The Judaica, in fact, presents an extensive list of the most powerful Jewish leaders of Bolshevism, which included Trotsky, Sverdlov, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Litvinov, Kaganovich, and many others. The Judaica also tells us just how many Jews fill the communist ranks. It says anti-Semitism drove the bulk of Russian Jewish youth into the ranks of the Bolshevik regime. When the white Russian patriots heroically attempted to regain their freedom from the Jews, the Judaica says compact Jewish masses were utilized by the Bolsheviks to suppress such counter-revolution. Clearly, Jews and native Russians were engaged in a death struggle over the destiny of Russia. Unfortunately, the Jewish masses won. A rare photo shows the First People's Commissariat. From left to right are Yuritsky, Trotsky, Zinoviev, Sverdlov, and Kaganovich, all Jewish. In 1918, intelligence services of the Western powers were buzzing with reports that communism was an international conspiracy fomented by atheistic Jews. British, Dutch, American, and other intelligence reports confirmed that Jews filled the Bolshevik ranks and that as much as 75% of all Soviet commissars were Jewish. In the Illustrated Sunday Herald of February 8, 1920, Sir Winston Churchill commented on what had almost become public knowledge. There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. It is certainly a very great one. In the decades following the revolution, the question became, how much influence do the Jews still exert on the Soviet experiment? Although many of the Jewish kingpins in Bolshevism perished in Stalinist purges in the late 30s, none other than Nikita Khrushchev gives us an eye-opening view of just how many Jews were still in the Soviet government. Speaking to a delegation of French socialists, Khrushchev admitted in 1956, the government has found in some of its departments a heavy concentration of Jewish people, upwards of 50% of the staff. Because communism has historically been top-heavy with Jews, the Soviet policy of so-called anti-Semitism, much protested by Jews in the West, may in reality be but a ploy to distract the world from communism's Jewish past. Although most Jews have indeed been removed from high-profile positions in the Soviet hierarchy over the last 30 years, still Jews remain highly favored when it comes to immigration to the prosperous West. Since World War II, more than 1 million Jews have been allowed to leave the Iron Curtain, sometimes in waves of up to 52,000 a year. This contrasts to the grim reality that if even one Gentile attempts to escape, he would be lucky to receive only 15 years in prison. Jews, then, have played an enormous role in the Soviet experiment.
Red Army units and the secret police agency set up by Lenin, known as the Cheka, had no compunction about using the most ruthless methods to deal with monarchists and other anti-communist groups. Tsar Nicholas II, his wife, and five children were executed by order of Lenin. In telegrams to his militants, Lenin ordered that all those who opposed the communist regime should be shot. The Bolsheviks arrested tens of thousands of people for the crime of opposing the regime. Most of these were tortured and executed en masse. The famous Russian writer Maxim Gorky described examples of Bolshevik savagery. In Tambov province, communists were nailed with railway spikes by their left hand and left foot to trees a meter above the soil. And they watched the torments of these deliberately, oddly crucified people. They would open a prisoner's belly, take out the small intestine, and nailing it to a tree or telegraph pole, they drove the man around the tree with blows, watching the intestine unwinding through the wound. Stripping a captured officer naked, they tore strips of skin from his shoulders in the form of shoulder straps. A terrible fear fell over Russia, but the communist savagery had only just begun. When the Bolsheviks came to power, most of the population of Russia lived in the villages, enjoying a pretty miserable standard of living. Most peasants were only just able to feed their families with what they produced. The freezing Russian winters made productive agriculture an impossibility. A decision taken by Lenin in 1918 inflicted an even worse disaster on millions of peasants who were already living in poverty. Private property was forbidden, and the peasants' goods were to be confiscated by the state. Lenin carried out that policy by means of another right-hand man, Felix Dzerzhinsky, the head of the Cheka, well known for his ruthlessness. Cheka officers descended on villages all over Russia and began rounding up peasants' crops and livestock at gunpoint. A quota to be handed over by every peasant and given to the Bolsheviks was drawn up. In order to meet that quota, most of them had to give up all that they possessed. Peasants who protested were silenced by the most savage means. On 14 February 1922, one inspector who visited the Omsk region wrote, "Abuses of position by the requisitioning detachments, frankly speaking, have now reached unbelievable levels. Systematically, the peasants who are arrested are all locked up in big, unheated barns. They are then whipped and threatened with execution. Those who have not filled the whole of their quota are bound and forced to run naked all along the main street of the village and then locked up in another unheated hangar." Lenin was enraged when he realized that the quota set for the villages would not be met. In 1920, he inflicted a fearful punishment on some regions that had resisted the requisitions. Not only would these peasants' crops be seized, but also all the seeds they possessed. Confiscating the seeds meant that the peasants would be unable to produce a new crop. In other words, they would have nothing to eat. Then the famine began. 29 million people within the borders of Russia battled with starvation. In 1921 and 1922, 5 million starved agonizingly to death. Lenin watched what was happening with enormous pleasure. In his view, the famine was most useful. He calculated that it would help to destroy people's belief in God and religion and make them bow their heads to communism. This is what Lenin wrote to the members of the Politburo on March 19, 1922. The present moment favors us. With the help of all those starving people who are starting to eat each other, who are dying by the millions, and whose bodies litter the roadside all over the country, it is now and only now that we can and therefore must confiscate all church property with all the ruthless energy we can muster. Our only hope is the despair engendered in the masses by the famine, which will cause them to look at us in a favorable light, or, at the very least, with indifference. Not only did Lenin regard human beings as a species of animal, he also employed animal methods to train them. In October 1919, he paid a personal visit to the Russian scientists Ivan Pavlov, famous for his conditioned reflex experiments on animals. Lenin wanted to impose these conditioned reflex methods on the whole of Russian society. Pavlov was astounded. "I want the masses of Russia to follow a communistic pattern of thinking and reacting," Lenin explained. Pavlov was astounded. It seemed that Lenin wanted him to do for humans what he had already done for dogs. "Do you mean that you would like to standardize the population of Russia? Make them all behave in the same way?" he asked. "Exactly," replied Lenin. "Man can be corrected. Man can be made what we want him to be."
The book begins with a quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. "You must understand, the leading Bolsheviks who took over Russia were not Russians. They hated Russians. They hated Christians. Driven by ethnic hatred, they tortured and slaughtered millions of Russians without a shred of human remorse. The October Revolution was not what you call in America the, quote, Russian Revolution. It was an invasion and conquest over the Russian people. More of my countrymen suffered horrific crimes at their blood-stained hands than any people or nation ever suffered in the entirety of human history." It cannot be overstated. Bolshevism committed the greatest human slaughter of all time. The fact that most of the world is ignorant and uncaring about this enormous crime is proof that the global media is in the hands of the perpetrators. That's from Nobel Prize winner Alexander Solzhenitsyn. These were startling words spoken to me by the famous Russian writer and philosopher Alexander Solzhenitsyn when I had the privilege of meeting him in Moscow in 2002. His words made me fully realize the fact that most of the people of the world know little about the tribalist entity which created and drove the communist juggernaut that took over Russia. They know frighteningly little about the greatest slaughters in history, the genocide of tens of millions of people that was spawned by deep ethnic hatred. For many people, even some of those who have studied the Russian Revolution in history courses in universities around the world, this is the secret behind communism. This secret, even though it's plain to see if one just looks closely, is rarely spoken about in either the mainstream press or in mainstream academia. The revolution occurred in Russia, and although a percentage of Russians participated in it, it was not a Russian revolution. It was led by an alienated, non-Russian, Jewish ethnic minority who hated Russia, Russians, and the Tsar for their alleged anti-Semitism. their fellow tribalists all over the world financed and supported and provided shock troops that executed the brutal takeover of the Russian government. Upon achieving total power, their deep, psychopathic, racist hatred against Russians became manifest in the greatest human slaughter of all time. Any historian who studied modern communism from its ideological origins in Karl Marx and Moses Hess through the mass dispossession, forced starvations, and gulags of the 20th century is aware that communists are the real world champions of mass murder. There is no historical dispute about the fact that communist regimes killed many more times the number of innocents than any other regime in history, including Hitler's Germany. But unlike members of the National Socialist regime, the greatest mass murderers of all time have not been hunted down across the face of the earth. They've not faced trial for their horrific crimes against humanity. Perhaps even more importantly, they've never faced the court of popular revulsion. Why? It's because these communist perpetrators have been shielded by their tribal brethren, who have an inordinate influence on media, academia, and in governments. The deaths in just one of the many communist killing fields totaled 5 to 8 million men, women, and children of the Ukraine who were starved, killed, imprisoned, and worked to death in what is today called the Holodomor. It totals a death number equal or even greater than the numbers in what today is called the Holocaust. Today, nearly every person on earth, through mass media and government commemoration, is aware of and empathizes with the victims of the Holocaust. But 99% of humanity are completely unaware of the Ukrainian Holodomor. The world has been inundated with both fictional and non-fictional dramas about the suffering of Jews and Jewish children, such as Anne Frank in the war. However, the great masses have not been led to shed tears for the little girls of Ukrainian and Russian heritage who suffered and died. They are unknown, unremembered, and unmourned in the media of today. People are unconscious and cut off from empathy for the millions murdered by the Bolsheviks in Russia, even if they have a vague knowledge of the millions suffering under communism. Very few people have an emotional attachment to the victims of the communists because Hollywood and the media have done nothing to instill any concern for them. That's in stark contrast to the unending dirge of the Jewish Holocaust. In the Hollywood media of movies and television and broadcasting and major publishing, every adult has absorbed thousands of hours of what is called the Holocaust. It is the trademarked jealous God which demands no other gods before it. I want to point out that I show a number of pictures of the Holodomor and other victims of Soviet communism, pictures that you're not so familiar with, that they don't show you constantly on television and in the newspapers. I show a picture of an emaciated, beautiful little girl who was starved to death in the intentional ethnic genocide of the Ukrainian people. You don't know her name. You don't know her story. The same Hollywood that brings you the Holocaust almost every day of your life shows you nothing about the largest genocide in the history of mankind. Why? When I met Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he just published his last work called 200 Years Together. It was about the Jewish experience in Russia and contained three chapters devoted to discussing the Jewish role in the revolutionary genocide and secret police purges of Soviet Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution of October 1917. I waited for 10 years in vain for the book to be published in English. It remains unpublished in English to this day. Of course, the secret behind communism must remain a secret to most of the public. Solzhenitsyn knew that he would be condemned for daring to point out the secret. But he went ahead nonetheless, telling me that it was his duty to tell the truth so that the world would know. He paid the price. Although the book was a runaway bestseller in Russia, this last important book by the Nobel Prize-winning author has never been published in English. So the largest audience in the world has been denied the truth. The controlled media had to mute this great man's voice. However, this book, The Secret Behind Communism, will somewhat remedy that suppression, for it contains many important and relevant quotations from 200 years together. Many of the revealing quotes that were the reason that the book has not been published fully in English. It wasn't the first time that Solzhenitsyn had raised the subject of the Jewish ethnic driving force behind communism and its slaughters in his famous The Gulag Archipelago books, 1, 2, and 3. He described his imprisonment by the Soviets, and he pointed out that almost all the commanders of the Gulag camps were Jews, by famously including pictures, which I show in my book, of 6 Jewish Czechist Gulag bosses of the 1930s. In 200 years together, Solzhenitsyn wrote that he had taken their pictures from an official Soviet-era publication which boasted about the gulags. Despite Solzhenitsyn's efforts and those of many others, including Frank Britton, and some of his excellent work and research is included in this volume, the truth about the Jewish supremacist role in the creation, execution, and maintenance of world communism, and the Russian Revolution in particular, remains little known. The reason for this is simple. The Jewish supremacist tribalists who influence major media throughout the West make sure that almost nothing is said about the fact that Jews, along with organized Jewish support worldwide, not only created communism, but were the leaders who brought it into such grim reality. They were indeed the nexus of the greatest slaughter and mass human suffering in history. This is the core of the secret behind communism, exposed and overwhelmingly documented in this book. Next section is the paramount Jewish role in communism, no secret in Israeli media. Ironically, Jewish historians are quite happy to discuss the leading Jewish role among themselves, although any Gentile who dares to raise the topic is immediately decried as a, quote, anti-Semite. A good example came with the article that appeared in the popular Israeli online Jewish Zionist news source called YNetNews.com. In December 2006, it shared an article with its Jewish readers called Stalin's Jews, which tells facts about the Jewish role in the mass murder in Russia that would certainly be criticized as anti-Semitic if any Gentile historian or publication had told these facts. The article written by well-known Jewish writer Sever Plocker is subtitled, quote, "We mustn't forget that some of the greatest murderers of modern times were Jewish." He goes on, "We cannot know with certainty the number of deaths Cheka was responsible for in its various manifestations, but the number is surely at least 20 million, including victims of the forced collectivization, the hunger, large purges, expulsions, banishments, executions, and mass death at gulags. Gingrich Yagoda was the greatest Jewish murderer of the 20th century, the GPU's deputy commander, and the founder and commander of the NKVD. Yagoda diligently implemented Stalin's collectivization orders and was responsible for the deaths of at least 10 million people. His Jewish deputies established and managed the Gulag system." Unquote. To understand the incredible level of deception about the enormous Jewish crimes against humanity, just consider how the globalist Jewish-dominated media hides Yagoda's role in a genocide of at least 10 million human beings. Jewish writers in a major Jewish Israeli website casually report to their Jewish readers that the Jewish Bolshevik Yagoda murdered twice the number of the alleged 5.1 million victims counted by the preeminent Holocaust historian, Raoul Hilberg. Next section. The Holocaust is, quote, never forget. The Bolshevik Holocaust is never remember. This genocidal murderer, who ironically has an identical mustache to Hitler, and who murdered double the number of people than are alleged against Hitler, is completely unknown. Not one person in 1,000 would be able to identify Yagoda's very distinctive name, much less associate it with mass murder. Why does the media tell us that we should never forget the Jewish Holocaust? But in regard to the much bigger Bolshevik Holocaust, the message is never remember. This illustrates the secret behind communism in a more profound way than this author could ever express. Subtitle, Ethnic Hatred Expressed in Both Communism and Zionism. This book exposes the little-known fact that Zionism and communism have the same ethnic and very similar ideological roots. Karl Marx was descended from a long line of Talmudic scholars, and he learned much of his communist theory from Moses Hess. Hess himself later morphed into a rabid Jewish racial supremacist and Zionist, while at the same time continuing to embrace the principles of communism. Tragically, the ethnic cleansings and murderous ways of the Jewish tribalists in Russia are being repeated in the Zionist ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Similar ethnic racism was at work in Palestine as it was in Russia and in other European nations. It can be seen in the ethnic genocide against the Ukrainians. The Jewish Bolsheviks purposefully murdered them to reduce their numbers and then flooded their country with non-Ukrainians to destroy their national and ethnic unity. More on this in the Holodomor chapter ahead. Raphael Lemkin, father of the word genocide, wrote this in his article, Soviet Genocide in Ukraine. Quote, the fourth step in the process, genocide, consisted in the fragmentation of the Ukrainian people at once by the addition to the Ukraine of foreign peoples. In this way, ethnic unity would be destroyed and nationalities mixed. Between 1920 and 1939, the population of Ukraine changed from 80% Ukrainian to only 63%. The Soviet archives in Moscow has this revealing statement from a Bolshevik leader in Ukraine showing the genocide there was to break their ethnic unity in opposition to Bolshevik rule. Quote, famine in Ukraine was brought on to decrease the number of Ukrainians, replace the dead with people from other parts of the USSR, and thereby to kill the slightest thought of any Ukrainian independence. This volume reveals how Israel today honors one of the worst Bolshevik criminals of the Second World War, Ilya Ehrenberg, and shows how Zionism embraces the same ethnic hatreds as did their Bolshevik brethren. The next subtitle is The Israeli Holocaust Museum Honors Bolshevik Promoter of Genocide Who Hid Bolshevik Crimes from the World. Ehrenberg was a leading international propagandist for the Bolshevik state while it committed the worst mass murder in history. He was also the chief propagandist for the Red Army, who urged on the genocidal mass murder of Germans and other Eastern Europeans. The Canadian Jewish News states, quote, until his death in 1967, his support for the Soviet state and for Stalin never wavered. His loyalty and service were acknowledged in 1952 when he received the Stalin Prize. He is most infamous for his viciously anti-German wartime propaganda. The Canadian Jewish News states, quote, as the leading Soviet journalist during World War II, Ehrenberg's writings against the German invaders were circulated among millions of Soviet soldiers. In one booklet called Kill, Ehrenberg incites Soviet soldiers to treat Germans as subhumans. Its final words include the following. Quote, Germans are not human beings. From now on, the word German means to use the most terrible oath. We shall kill. If you have not killed at least one German a day, you have wasted that day. If you cannot kill your German with a bullet, kill them with your bayonet. If there is calm on your part of the front, or if you're waiting for the fighting, kill a German in the meantime. If you leave a German alive, the German will hang a Russian and rape a Russian woman. If you kill one German, kill another. There's nothing more amusing for us than a heap of German corpses. Do not count days. Do not count kilometers. Count only the number of Germans you kill. Kill the German. That is your grandmother's request. Kill the German. That is your child's prayer. Kill the German. That is your motherland's loud request. Kill. Unquote. Ehrenberg's incendiary writing certainly contributed in no small measure to the orgy of murder and rape by Soviet soldiers against German and other Eastern European civilians. I also show a headline from the Daily Mail from historians talking about the mass rape. The headline reads, Red Army, millions of Eastern Europeans, women and girls, raped. The Canadian Jewish News further writes, quote, the recent disclosure that Ehrenberg arranged to transfer his private papers to Jerusalem's Yad Vashem Library and Archive, while still alive, comes as a stunning revelation. Ehrenberg agreed on condition that the transfer and his will remain secret for 20 years after his death. So we discover that a dedicated Bolshevik Soviet leader whose propaganda hid the Bolshevik Holocaust had secretly willed his private papers not to the Soviet Union, but to the Zionist state, where he is honored today at Yad Vashem. The honoring of a genocidal Bolshevik at Yad Vashem, the most important Jewish memorial to the Holocaust, speaks of an enormous hypocrisy that boggles the mind. Only in a deeply corrupted morality could the most important memorial in the world against genocide honor a man who supported genocide. More importantly, there is not a word of criticism in the press. It seems that one man's genocidal maniac is another man's hero. Zionist Israel today honors leaders who openly promote ethnic genocide in words just as horrific as Ehrenberg's. The former chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, calls for the extermination of the Palestinians. BBC quotes him in the following, quote, it is forbidden to be merciful to them. You must send missiles to them and annihilate them. They are evil and damnable. He was quoted as saying in a sermon delivered on Monday to mark the Jewish festival of Passover. Quote, the Lord shall return the Arabs' deeds on their own heads, waste their seed, and exterminate them, devastate them, and banish them from the world, he said. Rabbi Yosef is the spiritual head of the powerful Shas Party, one of the Israeli prime minister's closest allies. He also has said that the, quote, the only purpose of Gentiles on earth is to serve Jews. Now, could one even imagine the world outrage if any political leader in America or Europe was in political partnership with someone who preaches that Jews must be exterminated? This alone reveals Zionist power in government and media across the world.
Hands tied behind the back, an expertly aimed shot in the neck, and the fall into a huge mass grave. They were killed by the Allies. The Soviet Union was killing people in this way for many years, both before and after it joined the Allies. These victims had no memorials. They were buried in anonymous mass graves. The murderous power that killed them and the powers that collaborated with the murderer were never actually prepared to talk about them. The memory of millions of innocent victims was erased from history. throughout the world likes to make jokes using popular symbols of the past. Communism, after all, was about equality and harmony. There was nothing wrong with the idea itself. Well, actually, there was.
Initially, when communists come to power, and that doesn't matter where, let it be in Russia, in Poland, in Cuba, in Nicaragua, it doesn't matter, in China. Initially, they destroy about 10% of the population, and that's very specific. This is used not just to kill enemies, they're not enemies, is to restructure the fabric of society. It's a social engineering. Top intellectuals, best workers, best engineers, they would kill them all. And then they will try to restructure the new society.
Hang at least 100 kulaks, execute the hostages, do it in such a way that people for hundreds of miles around will see and tremble. Lenin. In 1917, the communists seized power. Lenin now had a chance to apply Marxism to real life.
Those who resisted were shot. There were terrible massacres against resisting peasants. And again, nobody knows exactly how many people died, but we're talking about 10 million or more.
Ukrainians were being exterminated in front of the whole world. But the world did nothing to help them. Mankind has never seen a more efficient extermination program than the one in Ukraine during the winter of 1932 and 33.
I don't think many people know that only socialists publicly advocated genocide in the 19th, 20th centuries. I think that's a very little known fact, and it seems shocking if you mention it. I've lectured on it here and in other universities, and it's always greeted with a sense of shock. First appeared in January 1849 in Marx's journal, Neue Rheinische Zeitung. Engels wrote of the how the class war in Marxian terms means that when socialist revolution happens, the class war happens, there will be primitive societies in Europe two stages behind, because they're not even capitalist yet. And he had in mind the Basques and the Bretons and the Scottish Highlanders and the Serbs, and he calls them racial trash, Völkerabfälle, racial trash. And they will have to be destroyed, because being two stages behind in the historical struggle, it will be impossible to bring them up to the point of being revolutionary.
He spoke about the vulgarity and dirtiness of Slavic people, you see. And he thinks, for instance, that Poland had has no reason to exist.
The classes and the races, too weak to master the new conditions of life, must give way. They must perish in the revolutionary Holocaust. Karl Marx.
Marx began it. He was the ancestor of modern political genocide. And I don't know that any European thinker of the modern period before Marx and Engels ever publicly advocated racial extermination. I can't find anything earlier, so I presume it starts with them.
The teachings of Marx and Engels were carefully studied by Lenin, the man who established the first Marxist country on earth.
You must all know half a dozen people at least who are no use in this world, who are more trouble than they are worth. Just put them there, and say, sir or madam, now will you be kind enough to justify your existence? If you can't justify your existence, if you're not pulling your weight in the social boat, if you're not producing as much as you consume, or perhaps a little more, then clearly we cannot use the big organization of our society for the purpose of keeping you alive, because your life does not benefit us, and it can't be of very much use to yourself.
Bernard Shaw believed in the mass killing by category, not usually by racial category, but by category, you know, the idle, the unfit.
Killing off the parasites within society was what Marxian socialism was about.
It demanded in a London newspaper that the scientists should devise a humane gas.
I appeal to the chemists to discover a humane gas that will kill instantly and painlessly. Deadly by all means, but humane, not cruel.
Stalin authorized in the middle of the 30s, because there was this problem of bezprizorni, he authorized children to be shot from the age of 12.
People were being shot day and night throughout the biggest country in the world. Stalin even got to the point of killing people by random, by quarters.
Let's say 100,000 in Tambov district. Okay, that's it. Whoever they grabbed and shot will be fulfilling quota. They wouldn't care about names. Then after the quotas were fulfilled, the local authorities would report to Stalin, to Central Committee, and asked for additional quotas. An additional quota will be given. And after fulfilling, they would again ask for additional quota. And so it will go in circles. It was like a like mincemeat machine, you know. It was just killing and killing and killing. Their idea was to destroy old order in Europe.
Thank you. Why are people afraid of the facts about Jews? I've met many different people, and I can say that there seems to be a general fear that arises in people when the facts about Jews come up. When I say facts about Jews, I mean pretty much things that there is overwhelming evidence against the Jews on. Bolshevism, for instance. There's no doubt that Bolshevism was a Jewish movement. Many people at the time knew it, and that includes people who were not necessarily enemies of the Jews. Winston Churchill, for instance, wrote an entire article on the Jews and communism, entitled Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People. In this article, Churchill said very clearly, and I quote, "This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky in Russia, Bela Kun in Hungary, Rosa Luxemburg in Germany, and Emma Goldman in the United States, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence, and impossible equality has been steadily growing." Churchill goes on to say, "There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. It is certainly a very great one. It probably outweighs all others. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of the leading figures are Jews." Of course, nowadays we know that Lenin was at least one quarter Jewish. But obviously that wasn't well known at the time. He goes on to say, "Moreover, the principal inspiration and driving power comes from the Jewish leaders." It really can't be much clearer than that. He's pretty much saying that Jews created Bolshevism, and that Bolshevism is a Jewish conspiracy which is created for the overthrow of civilization. And that's not Adolf Hitler saying that. That's not Father Coughlin saying that. That's not Henry Ford saying that. That's Winston Churchill. And of course, many Jews confirm this themselves, albeit very quietly. The Jewish World in London, April 16, 1919, page 11, said, "The Jews have been furnishing for the Bolsheviks the majority of their leaders." Anti-Semitism and the Jewish Question, in London, 1942, page 31, said, "Karl Marx, who came from an old family of rabbis and brilliant Talmudic scholars, was to point the path of victory for the proletariat." Rabbi Stephen Wise, in the American Bulletin of May 15, 1935, said, "Some call it Marxism, I call it Judaism." Rabbi Wise was also a liaison for President Roosevelt and President Wilson. Harry Wotton, in A Program for the Jews and an Answer to All Anti-Semites, published in New York for the Committee of the Preservation of the Jews in 1939, page 143, states, "The communist soul is the soul of Judaism." The Menorah Journal in New York from July to September 1932, page 106, states, "It would be absurd to deny the intensity of the Jewish participation in the Russian revolutionary movement." The American Hebrew stated on September 10, 1920, "That achievement, the Russian Revolution, destined to figure in history as the overshadowing result of the World War, was largely the outcome of Jewish thinking, of Jewish discontent, and of Jewish effort to reconstruct." Now that's very similar to what Churchill said, that this was a movement to overthrow and reconstitute society on the basis of arrested development. The Jewish Voice, published in New York from the National Council of Jewish Communists, January 1942, page 16, stated, "The Jewish people will never forget that the Soviet Union was the first country, and as yet the only country in the world in which anti-Semitism is a crime." It was punishable by death, by the way. The same source said in a year before, on page 23, "Anti-communism is anti-Semitism." I could go on. There's a whole library of quotes on this, but I think you get the point. You can look them up yourself if you want to see more of them. And if quotes aren't good enough for you, then I would just tell you to look up the people who actually pushed communism. Look at their biographies. Look at their family history. Leon Trotsky, real name Lev Bronstein, the son of wealthy Jewish wine producers, also author of the book In Defense of Terrorism, which was a book that encouraged terror to be used against counter-revolutionaries. He was also founder and leader of the Red Army as well as the leader of the First People's Commissariat, along with four other revolutionaries, all of whom were also Jews. Karl Marx, author of the Communist Manifesto, real name Karl Mordecai, the son of Rabbi Herschel Mordecai. And you know Mordecai was the name of the Jewish hero in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the book of Esther, who helped undermine the Persian government, similarly to what the communists did to the Russian government and to the other Eastern European governments, and tried to do to Germany also, before they were stopped by Hitler. And those are just a few of the top Jews that were involved in it, but the list really goes on and on. This prompted many people, even in our own government, to take notice of the Jewish leadership and involvement in Bolshevism. David R. Francis, the U.S. ambassador to Russia in 1918, while he was in Russia, remarked, "The Bolshevik leaders here, most of whom are Jews, and 90% of whom are returned exiles, care little for Russia or any other country, but are internationalists, and they are trying to start a worldwide social revolution." Right in line with what Churchill said. So there is no doubt, really, that Bolshevism was a Jewish movement, and you can come up with any excuse you want to try and excuse it, but fact of the matter is it was a Jewish movement.
Not only that, but if you look at the history of the Jews over the last 2,000 years, have they been blessed by God? No, they've been persecuted and hated in every country that they've ever been in. This book right here has a list of all of the countries that the Jews have been thrown out of over the last 1,000 years. And when you look at this huge list, you have to ask yourself, why have they been so hated and persecuted everywhere that they've lived? And the answer is because of their blasphemy toward Christianity and because of their predatory lending practices. The Balfour Declaration was a letter written to Lord Rothschild. So in order to understand the Balfour Declaration, we have to know who Rothschild was.
Money is power. Money is the only weapon that the Jew has to defend himself with.
Meyer Amschel Bauer, born in Frankfurt, Germany in 1744, was a moneylender and a goldsmith on Jew Street, whose shop had a sign out front with a red hexagram on it. Eventually, he would change his name to Rothschild, which is German for red sign. Rothschild soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning money to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Meyer Rothschild had five sons whom he trained in the skills of money creation and sent out to the major capitals of Europe to open branches of the family banking business.
You are five brothers. I want you each to start a banking business in a different country. One to go and open a house in Paris, one in Vienna, one in London. Choose the most important centers. So that when money is to be sent from here to London, let us say, you won't have to risk life and gold and kill here in Frankfurt. We'll just send a letter to Nathan in London saying, pay so-and-so. And that will be offset by loans from London to Frankfurt. Understand?
Yes.
In your day, there will be many wars in Europe. And nations that have money to transport will come to the Rothschilds because it will be safe. Your five banking houses may cover Europe, but you will be one firm, one family, the Rothschilds, who work always together. That will be your power.
When Meyer Amschel Rothschild died in 1812, he left a will instructing his sons in how the House of Rothschild would be operated. All key positions in the House of Rothschild were to be held by members of the family. The family was to intermarry with their own first and second cousins, thus preserving the vast fortune. Rothschild's heirs were strictly forbidden to ever disclose the amount of their wealth. The whole family was driven by an insatiable lust for the accumulation of wealth and power. They secretly financed both sides in various European wars, dominated European banking, and by the mid-1800s had become the richest family in the world.
Rothschild helped found Israel, and Rothschild has always been the backer of Israel. Whatever Rothschild wants, he gets. It is believed that he is the richest man in the world. And I have little doubt of that.